Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
An upscale mall in Nairobi has turned into a battleground. Armed men stormed Westgate Mall in the Kenyan capital just before lunchtime, firing weapons and throwing grenades. What appears to witnesses to be at least a dozen gunmen have taken hostages inside. Others have reported that there have been unsubstantiated reports. No, let me not do those ones. Kenyan police and counter-terrorism officers are on the scene.
I almost feel like I need to start with a caveat that all these other stories that we've, gotten to do together,
there's been frequent gunfire and
have been me telling you a story as a journalist. I feel like this story, it's going to be a story where I'm going to have to stop being a journalist at some point.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I am Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. I keep waiting for you to say the podcast, but we don't do that anymore.
Oh, we don't say that anymore.
The guy you just heard, that was NPR's East Africa correspondent, Greg Warner, who's done a bunch of stories with us. Recently, he came to us with another one. It was all about a struggle he was having trying to figure out how to tell a story that is true. I'll just leave it at that.
It's actually a story about the aftermath of an event that probably got more media coverage than almost any event in East Africa last year, and that is the terrorist attack on Westgate Mall in Nairobi. This was September 21st, 2013. It was a kind of balmy Saturday afternoon. Westgate Shopping Mall, crowded with more than 1,000 shoppers. Even more families than usual were there that day because there was a children's cooking competition. In fact, the kids were just setting up their ingredients. Parents had just taken their seats when shortly after noon, gunmen entered the building, shooting AK-47s, going floor to floor, killing people, and the siege would last for 4 days. Now, for 4 days, essentially, I and, dozens of international and local journalists are outside the mall listening to the sounds of gunfire. Trying to guess what's happening inside, because the press is, of course, not allowed in while this battle is ongoing. Meanwhile, I'm getting on the air every hour sometimes, trying to just piece things together.
Once they were inside, they continued to shoot. I'm mentioning there's a plume of tear gas coming my way, so I'm going to have to try not to cough as I'm answering this question.
Gregory, move as you need to move,
again,
by all means.
But my point is that there was no information at the scene other than this gunfire. What there was were a whole bunch of survivors.
How do you feel?
Helpless. Helpless, yeah.
In fact,
so many,
all the journalists, myself included, were racing around interviewing eyewitnesses.
Everybody was really running for their lives.
Talking to them and also to Kenyan officials to get a picture of what happened. And the story that emerges from those interviews is basically this, that the number of terrorists inside that mall, or at least in the beginning, was 10 to 15 gunmen.
Between 10 and 15 gunmen.
10 to 15 attackers.
Up to 15 armed militants.
The profile is multi-ethnic.
Came from Kenya, the United Kingdom, and, Arab origin.
This is like a rainbow coalition of Somalis, Kenyans, Arabs, mostly men, but also including a British woman.
A young British woman they call the White Widow.
Eyewitnesses on different floors of the mall, all talking about their gunmen, the people they saw. And it's this multi-ethnic group. And then, of course, perhaps most alarmingly for those of us, living in Nairobi, there's reports that at least one gunman had, after shooting some people, thrown away his gun and actually escaped with the fleeing shoppers. We hear that from a couple witnesses. So that's the initial story. But it's not really until 8 weeks later, in November, that U.S. officials invite about a dozen British and American journalists into a conference room in the U.S. Embassy. And we meet an official there from the FBI. Now, we had known that the FBI was involved in the postmortem analysis.
Forensic teams from the United States and Europe joined the investigation.
Because this is like a global terrorism event, so Kenya had invited Scotland Yard and the FBI to figure out who these terrorists were. But the FBI had not actually said anything officially. And this meeting inside the U.S. Embassy was on what's called deep background, which isn't even off the record. It's a deeper level of secrecy. We weren't at that time even allowed to say that a U.S. official had said any of this stuff. This was just information for us to know. Since then, I can talk about this meeting because everything that was revealed there has now become a part of the public record. In fact, the FBI has come out publicly and said all these things. But at the time, this was new. And what the FBI person said at the time was that his team had access to all the closed-circuit camera footage. Remember, this is a mall. It's a modern mall, so there's cameras everywhere. He's seen it from the beginning to the end of the attack from all those different perspectives. And that according to that footage, everything that we had reported in those first few days was wrong.
Wrong in what way?
Well, for instance, 10 to 15 terrorists... No, there weren't 10 to 15 terrorists, there were four.
Four. Huh.
They also said, okay, you've been reporting this this multi-ethnic coalition of Arabs, Kenyans, and Somalis that so many eyewitnesses told you. No, they're all Somalis. They're all Somali ethnicity, all four of them. And there's also no evidence that any of the gunmen escaped.
I'm just curious, from his perspective, where's he trying to... I don't know, what was your read on this meeting?
You know, I actually felt, and I know other... people in that room felt a huge sense of relief because, you know, here we are, all are trying to do the work of journalism, you know, trying to get credible testimony. And suddenly here's a guy saying, okay, take away all that speculation, all those contradictory stories, all those different reports. Here's some objective evidence. You can't see this tape because it's secret for various anti-terrorism reasons, but this is solid. And after that time,
details tonight about the
everybody was reporting the same thing.
Unreleased surveillance video shows four armed assailants.
Only four terrorists.
There are four terrorists.
Security cameras show four armed assailants.
All four suspects are believed to be from Somalia.
They're all Somalis.
So confirmed that all four were killed.
And none escaped.
The attackers are now dead.
So it kind of put a cap on all those conspiracy theories and speculations that were really filling the media.
You weren't the slightest bit curious about why, what might have been left out?
Well, I mean, what I guess I really felt was sort of empty because I'm not only a reporter in Nairobi, or I'm also a person living in Nairobi. I mean, I live here. You know, I go to dinner parties, I take my kid to birthday parties, and... You know, I remember especially then in the first months after Westgate, where so many people in that mall, invariably somebody would be there at the party who had their own survivor story. And, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, well, that was all this eyewitness testimony. You know, it's not accurate. But it's another thing to look into the eyes of somebody who's sitting there with a paper plate of cake in their hand telling you that the terrorist that they saw is not the terrorist that they saw on this bit of footage that had been released and was playing on heavy rotation on Kenyan television.
Did that happen more than once?
It was, yeah, it happened much more than once. I mean,
do you want me to use only your first name?
You can say Puni, my nickname.
I'll give you an example. My friend Puni, okay, yeah. Former neighbor of mine in Nairobi. That Saturday morning, she went into the Westgate Mall to get a present for her friend's daughter.
I think it was a puzzle, a little puzzle for a four-year-old girl. And I'm standing there, I'm just about to pay, and then... boom! Explosion.
Automatic weapons.
You know, they were shooting, you could hear the grenades. And
she says she ran out of the store, passing a bunch of chairs and tables that had been set up for that cooking competition.
I didn't have much time to think, I just ducked under one of those tables. And then it got quiet. You could hear people praying, muttering prayers.
She said she heard a man
gasping for breath.
And she says at one point, another woman was under the table with her.
Her and I were literally, yeah, squeezed together. She was pregnant.
She was pregnant?
Yeah. And that's the first thing she said. She's like, I'm pregnant and I'm shot. I didn't have the presence of mind to help her. She basically took one of those drapes and wrapped it around her leg to stop the bleeding. Later on, I mean, because we were there for quite some time, she said to me, I'm dying. And yeah, at that point, I was stroking her hair, saying, no, you're not, you're fine. It's just your leg, it's just your leg.
And Puni says that while she was under that table, she would try to peek up.
Through the cloth, and for the longest time, I couldn't see anything. Finally, I see the guys. There was two young boys. Cute little young, innocent-looking boys. You know, yeah, it's hard to imagine. You can't reconcile what they're doing with how they look. One of them was kind of, I don't know, maybe a 17, 18-year-old kid.
And cute?
I mean, I could just see him as being the son of one of my friends. This particular one who was closest to us was wearing a red t-shirt.
And here's where you get to a small but significant discrepancy that still haunts Puni. She says she is sure that the two guys she saw, and they're just a few feet away from her, were wearing short sleeve shirts.
And afterwards, I keep seeing these images of four guys, none of whom were wearing short sleeve. I mean, at the beginning, if you remember, they were saying there were 15 guys. So then it kind of made sense that, well, the two guys that I saw were different from the four that we're seeing on TV.
But then when people like me started to report that there were only four,
categorically only four guys, then I started to say, wait a minute. I saw their arms. I know I saw short sleeve t-shirts. You know, it just does not make sense. Nothing adds up. You start to think, am I crazy? Is my mind playing tricks on me? I think I saw one thing and then I didn't, but I'm quite sure I saw this. I mean, every day, every moment of the day, you're thinking about what happened? What happened that day?
You know, at these parties, I would hear all of these stories, like Puni's, that weren't the official narrative, and yet they felt real. All the details seemed weird enough to be true, surreal enough to be true. You know, another person was talking about this powerful story where this man was shooting, and then he got a phone call and stopped shooting long enough to answer the phone and then hang up and start shooting again. I mean, it's like, you don't make details like that up. And this is what I think made things so awkward at those conversations, because they knew that the terrorist they saw was different than on the video. And what that left them was two things. One is that I might think that they were lying, and that two, that the terrorist that haunts them is still out there.
You know, that guy could just be around. He could see me again.
And here's where things get a little weird. Okay, so this is 4 months later. Definitely the news cycle has kind of moved on. As a journalist, I don't really have to report on Westgate anymore. It's Saturday afternoon again. Actually just at home with my kid. And I get a phone call.
It's a call that kind of upended the whole story for him. And that's after the break.
This is Darlene calling from Kampala, Uganda. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/Radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/Radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/Radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hey, Lulu here. You asked and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and we'll get back to reporter Greg Warner's story of the aftermath of the Westgate terror attack in Nairobi, Kenya. You just heard the beginning.
We're now going to tell you the end, if there is an end.
Yeah, and we'll pick things up with Greg getting a phone call.
I get a phone call.
From a guy we haven't met yet, a guy named Farouk. Now, Farouk is not his real name. He asked Greg to change his name for the story. It'll become clear why. A bit later.
And now, Farouk.
Can we go further up, please? Please, because sure. We're right in the line of fire.
Farouk is one of the first people I met in the parking lot on that first day of the attack.
Because everybody was, I just heard gunfire, gunshots, and I was just, everybody was running away.
When I met him, he was actually trying to reach his fiance.
She's stuck in there.
Still in there?
Yeah. She's not picking the phone. I've even written the message. I wrote the message that I'm okay, how are you? But she's not responded yet. Even I lost my specs.
He had lost his eyeglasses as he was fleeing, so...
Oh, let me see if you want me to look. What name are you looking for?
I had to read it. He hadn't gotten a text from her.
I wrote her messages, no reply. Then I called her, no reply.
What happened to her?
Was she killed?
Yeah, she was later found among the bodies at the morgue.
Oh, gosh.
But then... A week later, I met back up with Farouk, and he told me some things that he had not told me that morning.
From first floor, everybody was going to second floor. So
he says there was this moment in the mall, utter panic, where a bunch of people were running up the escalator, and one of the terrorists came down the opposite way, down the escalator.
And this guy was pushing everybody down with shootings.
Somehow, Farouk says, he got spun around in the opposite direction of the crowd. And
then I saw him.
He gets a good look at this guy.
I saw the person very clearly. This person, he was an Arab guy.
He says he's sure of it.
Yes.
And then he says that he ran and found a hiding spot.
And after some time...
He pokes his head out and he saw him again.
When I saw this guy, he was changing his clothes.
Into what?
He had clothes on him, no? But he removed those clothes. Then he was wearing another clothes inside. Another clothes inside.
Basically, he says that after that first part of the siege, the guy changed his clothes, dropped his gun, and then insinuated himself into the crowd.
And when we came out, this guy joined us. He joined us. So when I saw him outside and I was telling everybody, he's one of them, he was one of them, but everybody was in shock. Nobody could see what I'm saying.
And do you know what happened to him?
No, I don't know. No idea.
Okay, so back to that phone call in January that I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. Farouk, he calls me out of the blue. He says, hey, I'm sitting in a bar at a place called Diamond Plaza, which is interesting because Diamond Plaza happens to be one of the prospective terrorist targets in Nairobi, a known terrorist target besides Westgate Mall. And he says, across from him, a few tables away, is the fifth gunman, the guy who got away.
Whoa.
I see him. He's at the next table. And he says, can you come?
And you actually went?
Well, at first I told him, you should just finish your beer and go home. I actually hung up. But then I thought, I probably shouldn't blow this guy off. If this were happening in the United States, I could have just said to the guy, look, if you're so sure about this, why don't you just call 911? But there is no 911 in Kenya. And so he called me. And I basically said to him, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, just let the police know. And then I did. I called a source that I know in the police department, and he called his people, and they said, okay, we're going to be right there. Where's his location? You know, they treated it seriously, so I took it seriously. Plus, there was this small but amazing possibility of this being an incredible scoop.
Yeah.
Okay, this is my plan, basically. I figured, like, okay, I'm going to wait downstairs until the police show up, and then, you know, cops style, I'm going to race up with them and sort of be behind the police, so I'll be able to witness it, but I'll be safe, right? But I get there, and the police are, like, not there yet. So I'm waiting downstairs at this bar. Farouk is calling me, like, where are you, man? And I say, well, I'm downstairs. And he's like, okay, come up.
Come on. Don't be scared. What are you scared of?
I don't think I should go upstairs.
Come on.
I'm like, I don't think this is a good idea.
Stay down here. No, come on. Come. You see the guy first. See the guy.
And as I'm sitting there arguing with him, he says, we have to hurry because I've invited this guy, this supposed terrorist, to sit with me at my table.
What?
You told him to sit with me.
You told him to sit with me?
Yeah.
I guess the guy was about to leave and Farouk didn't want him to leave, so he jumped up and somehow convinced this guy, this stranger, to sit and have a drink with him at the table.
And he's really scared now.
He's scared. Hold on, let me go.
Don't be scared, man.
I think it's going to alert him that
it's okay. Even the OCS, the OCPD are here. Let's go.
But
you come. You are a friend of mine.
But the police are about to come.
No. Come.
So I come up. I walk into this bar, past the pool table, you know, to this outdoor bar. He brings me to the table, and
this is from Yemen.
Oh, from Yemen.
Yeah.
And there's this guy.
No English, no Swahili.
Late 20s, fairly slender. He was wearing a t-shirt, black jeans. One odd detail that stood out to me was that he was wearing two watches.
Really?
What are you taking?
Tusker. So I sit down, order a beer, make up this terribly lame story about why I'm there.
I mean, all right, I was just getting a phone case from my wife.
Were you able to talk to the guy?
Yeah, well, the guy didn't speak English, so...
Do you like Nairobi?
No, he doesn't know English.
I did try to engage this guy in conversation. He didn't really understand what I was saying, except for very basic stuff. But within a few minutes of my sitting down, the police finally arrive.
Come on. Yeah, these are the officers. This is the OCS. For you.
Hi, Gregory. Right away, Farouk jumps up, IDs the guy who is completely confused about what's going on.
I saw this person.
That's what you said. Explains that he was at the mall the day of the attack.
I told you, no, my wife got 3 bullets.
And so the police start to question the guy. And the interaction is very suspicious. They ask him where he's from. He says Nairobi, even though he had told us that he's from Yemen. And then they ask him for a passport, and then he says, oh, I don't have my passport, but then he does, and then he says, oh, I'm from Yemen. So anyway, so that's enough for the police. They put the rubber handcuffs on him, and they take him away.
Well, how did the guy react?
He seemed high, actually. Something I hadn't mentioned was that the guy had been chewing a narcotic leaf. It's called mirah or khat. And so he seemed, you know, like a scared high person, you know, where you're scared, but you're kind of numb to whatever everything that's happening. It all seems like a dream. I mean, this is like very conjectural, but what was not conjectural was that as the police were leading him out, Farouk just loses it.
You want to kill me? Kill me, but you kill my wife. Now you want to kill me?
He says, you killed my wife.
You
mother. He starts cursing at the guy, you know.
And I don't give a about anyone.
And then he starts just shouting so that anyone at the bar can hear him.
He's the person who was shooting. Him. Huh?
He's the one.
Like, it's all we could do to kind of calm him down.
I mentioned something 4 months back, didn't I? You know, my family is saying you are putting your life in risk. I said I don't have a life. I lost my life. So why should I care? I saw him and he was watching me. He shot my love, man. How can I let it go? This is the guy.
You're sure?
110%.
And that's when the call to prayer comes out of the speakers from a nearby mosque.
This guy is the one.
And Farouk ranted all the way through it.
Going right now. This is the guy.
He then left directly from the bar to go to the police station to give his statement. And I felt really bad, actually. I never felt like I was doing something wrong, per se, but I felt that harm had come to this person. And actually, at that point, I didn't feel that he was a terrorist, and I just hoped that the system to which I had helped commit him would treat him fairly. After that, I kept calling the police station every few days. About 10 days later, I found out the guy was released and he hadn't been charged with anything. And at that point, I was like, all right, great. This all worked out fine. Poor guy was in the wrong place at the wrong time and, you know, got falsely ID'd possibly. But look, everything is done. Everything kind of worked out the way it was supposed to. And that's what I assumed, you know, for months, basically, and kind of like went off to do other kinds of reporting, other stories. But a few months later, I was talking to that police source again, and I happened to mention we were talking about a different story. I said, yeah, whatever happened to that guy from Yemen, that fellow that was picked up at Diamond Plaza? And he said, oh, you know, it's funny, the witness that you told us about,
he did not show up.
He never showed up.
He didn't show up?
He didn't show up. They called him for 3 consecutive days, but our man never showed up.
I said, what? Farouk never showed up to give his testimony? Like, you can hear from the tape.
I'm going right now.
The one thing
that's
so clear is that he's on his way over to the police station, full barrels blazing. And so I call Farouk.
Sorry, the mobile subscriber will not be reached.
And his phone is off. And then I call him a week later, his phone is still off. It's giving this, like, this phone number is no longer in service kind of thing. So it's actually not until close to the year anniversary of Westgate that I get a call.
Yeah, are you okay?
Yeah. I've been trying your number, and it hasn't worked for weeks.
No, I've just come back. I was out of the country.
And it's Farouk, and he's very nervous. He says, are you alone? Asking me not to record this conversation, and he tells me, he had gone to the police station, just as I suspected. He marched right over to the police station. And they told him, oh, well, no, this is being handled by the anti-terrorism police. So you leave your phone number and the anti-terrorism police will give you a call. A week later, he started getting calls, several calls from unknown numbers, where people who did not identify themselves threatened him, told him not to say anything about this guy he had arrested, not to talk to the press, or he'd be sorry and his family would be sorry. He was extremely rattled by these phone calls and ultimately actually turned off his phone. That's why I couldn't get a hold of him. Had left the country for a short bit, had come back and was laying very low. And that's why I'm using an assumed name for him. Well, I'm not telling his full name because he doesn't want that.
And do you believe the stories about the threats? And
I have absolutely no way of knowing for sure.
Yeah.
That part of his story, though, seemed the most likely to be true. The fact that the anti-terrorism police had called him allegedly and made threats, that does not sound strange, unfortunately, to me. I've heard that story from lots of very credible people.
Does this make what he saw truer or untrue? Or we don't?
I don't know. Suddenly, I found myself less willing to discount the story. And I was less comfortable with the official narrative than I wanted to be at that point. So I called up one more guy, a guy who was not a government official, who was not the FBI, and yet who had seen all the videotapes from the mall.
Okay.
So can you just give me your name and your title?
My name's Dan Reed. I'm a producer and director of documentaries, most recently Terror at the Mall, which was made for HBO and the BBC.
And for that documentary, Dan got exclusive access to all the surveillance footage inside that mall.
Right.
I figured if there were more to this story, he could tell me. So how much footage did you get, if I can ask? I mean, how many hours are out there?
The footage we obtained added up to about more than 2,000 hours.
Wow.
And we analyzed the timeline, where the cameras were, and we figured out the offsets between different cameras. We really did a huge forensic job. It's mind-numbingly tedious to watch a lot of it, but if you do go through it, you do get the key to a lot of the mysteries of Westgate.
Like me, he'd gone into this project open-minded.
There were some very kind of, you know, sober, sensible people who said, yeah, there were seven terrorists. I saw seven terrorists. I mean, you dream of being able to confirm that there were seven gunmen. You dream of being able to confirm that they all escaped. What if that were true? What if we could find evidence, some evidence, that that were true?
But in the end, he didn't.
No. As we progressed further and further with our forensic analysis, it became harder and harder to give any credit to some of the wilder pieces of eyewitness.
He says what you see on those tapes is what the FBI said you'd see. Four guys, all Somali, no evidence they escaped.
Exactly.
Well, then how does he square the stories you were hearing with the stories you were reporting?
Well,
that part was actually quite interesting.
We had a lot of people say, yeah, there was a woman.
Young British woman they called the White Widow.
And it's interesting because when I was going through this footage, my wife looked over my shoulder.
Pointed to one of the four terrorists on the screen.
And at one point she said, oh, is that a girl? And we came to the conclusion that one of the gunmen was, you know, very slender, and he actually does sashay along in what is frankly quite an effeminate way.
And similarly, he says, you can justify some of the reports that one of the gunmen was an Arab because one of them did in fact have lighter skin than your average Somali. And you can explain that people thought that there were more gunmen, 10 or 15 gunmen, because there were a lot of guys with guns running around, including security guards and later policemen.
There were a lot more policemen than there were gunmen.
I did speak with one eyewitness who said that he saw one of the terrorists change clothes and escape.
Well,
is it a story you've heard about?
No, that doesn't match anything that we saw. I think the question to ask your eyewitnesses is how do you know this person with a weapon who changed clothes was a terrorist? It may have been a policeman. We certainly heard stories of policemen taking off, changing clothes or taking off any distinctive clothing. I don't know if those stories were true, but we heard stories. But,
oh, you know, so people were saying that uniformed policemen took off their uniform.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want to fight.
I guess, yeah. I mean, that's pure, Greg. I mean, you know,
right. There it's totally speculation, and you did not see that on any of the security.
We
cameras.
Certainly didn't. I mean, I've just had so many conversations, like people saying to me, "No, they escaped," and I'm like, "Why do you think they escaped? You know, these guys don't come to escape. If you escape, you fail."
He says, "Take the 2008 terrorist attack in Mumbai.
They had murdered 35 people at the hotel."
This is another film that he made. There's a moment in that film where one of the gunmen. One of the last remaining gunmen.
The guy is trapped in a hotel room, and he's in the bathtub next to his comrade who's dead, who's dying.
He's talking to one of his handlers on the cell phone. Dan was able to get a recording of that call.
And the handlers very calmly say to him, you know, your mission will not be a success until you are killed. And then they say to him, please leave your phone on, switched on, leave the line open in your pocket so that we can hear when you go out and are killed by the enemy security forces. So there is a whole script for this kind of operation, and it ends with the death of the gunman at the hands of the enemy.
Wow. That's how he knows they didn't escape, he says. Not just because there's no evidence on the film, but because it's the last thing they would have wanted. And yet...
I mean, the rumors that the terrorists escaped, the rumors that there was a woman amongst them, the rumors that they got changed, the rumors, they don't seem to go away even when confronted by quite solid evidence. It's almost... as if the facts don't matter.
So I called Farouk. He's still sticking to his story. He says he saw what he saw, though he's really too nervous to go on tape. But I did run it by Puni, my former neighbor in Nairobi, who's
100%
still pretty sure that the guy she saw in the mall hasn't been accounted for.
I think I'm sure about it, but...
What if the government said, here's the bodies, here's the DNA evidence, here's the four. They'd all died, they died on the second day, or third day, or whatever it was. This is how they died, and here's the DNA proof.
You know, what would really make me happy is if they even asked the questions, be it the media, be it the government, why did we go from 15 to 4?
Yes. So I told her.
I can quickly tell you how we arrived at 4.
I told her about the meeting with the FBI and how we got this information. Then I told her about Dan Reed watching 2,000 hours of videotape. And I told her about how I investigated Farouk's story and mostly came up empty. I told her not just everything that I know, all these facts, but how I got to them. Because in the end, maybe the facts aren't enough. The facts need to make sense, especially for people who were there.
But I can imagine for anybody who was not there, anybody who's reading it, yeah, the evidence says, and then you move on.
You know, listening to you, I feel like I'm learning much more about my job and being a journalist, and maybe it's not so pretty, because I feel like that day coming out of that meeting with the FBI and feeling like, okay, now we have some solid evidence that can be reported and we can move on, felt good. I mean, it felt like offering, instead of offering shaky as testimony, we could offer truth, at least as best we could understand it. But it feels like maybe that was too sudden and too uninquisitive in a way to match the emotions that were still in the air in Nairobi at that time. Maybe it felt like abandonment, even though it was meant to feel like clarity.
Mm. For me, it's still, there's a little glimmer of maybe that's not the full story. I am inclined to believe that there were four, but then it's like what I saw does not make sense. And that I'll never be able to really reconcile, and I just kind of have to leave it at that.
A lot of people to thank for this story. Of course, Greg Warner, first and foremost, NPR's East Africa correspondent. And also...
thanks very much to Jason Straziuso.
Blogger Robert Alai.
Heidi Vogt. NPR International Editor Didi Skenke.
And Senior International Editor Edith Chapin for allowing us to borrow Greg on our show. Up next, a confusing story about some confusing terrorist suspects.
It's so confusing. In fact, I think it's hard to tell whether this threat is real or just... confusing.
Exactly. That is coming up, so stay tuned.
Hello, this is Ryan Jones, and I'm calling from my dorm room in Seattle, Washington. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.
All right, we're back. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich. This is Radiolab.
So in the last segment, we were talking about the aftermath of the Westgate terror attacks and the trouble that journalists sometimes have trying to figure out what actually happened.
For the next story, we're going to go in the other direction. We're going to look at what happens prior to a terrorist attack. And this is a story that draws a murky line between a threat that might be empty and a threat you should take very seriously.
We got to it because our producer, Pat... Do you just want to get in here?
Hey,
this is Pat Walters.
Yes.
So maybe you should set this up since you put this in front of us.
Yeah, this one comes from a writer named Tom.
Tom Juneau, writer at large with Esquire magazine.
Who I've wanted to get on the show for a really long time. It's about a pretty recent police bust that happened a few months back that Tom's been covering.
Maybe we should just start with should we just like follow the chronology of your reporting?
Sure.
I mean, how did you get into this?
Yeah, how did it start with you?
Well, I got into it... came out, you know, in the local newspaper. It was a, you know, front page story that came out on November 2nd.
Where's local for you, just so we know?
I live in Marietta, Georgia, and
okay.
Local for me is the Atlanta, Georgia area. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution ran a front page story with an illustration of these guys by the sketch artist that showed these guys, you know, being arraigned, four guys in their orange jumpsuits. And the headline was interesting. It said... they don't fit the profile. It wasn't four arrested, subhead, they don't fit the profile. The headline was, they don't fit the profile.
To explain, the article described four guys who had been caught on tape planning to buy explosives.
Are you, got, what are you looking for C4? I can get it.
We are.
Explosives they were going to use to blow up a federal building in Atlanta, killing... presumably hundreds of government employees.
IRS, ATF, FBI, and the cops.
They'd even looked into making this chemical called ricin, which is one of the deadliest poisons known to man.
Arsenic takes 100 granules to kill someone. Ricin takes 1 to 2 granules.
Yeah, ahead of a pin.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
On tape, they talk about taking this poison and dispersing it in public places up and down the East Coast.
Newark, New Jersey... Jacksonville, Florida, Highway 95 in North Carolina and South Carolina.
Which theoretically could have killed hundreds more people.
They were motivated by an overarching desire to incite civil war, in which case, you know, the right side would battle and win and constitutional government would be restored in the United States.
Now, what made them not fit the profile was... Well, you could see it right there on the front page in the court sketch.
Their white hair, their white beards.
These were not your usual teenage terrorists. These guys, at least some of them, were in their 70s. They were retirees.
I mean, the thing that interested me about it in the beginning was the thing that interested a lot of people, which is the fact that, you know, guys like this who you see sort of chewing the fat at the local Waffle House, Shoney's, McDonald's, you know, the coffee klatch of retirees. And, you know, you always pass these guys and, you know, you see them every day and you go, well, what are these guys talking about? In this case, they were talking about, you know, killing people in mass numbers.
We know what we want to do. We know how to do it. What we need to be is prepared to do it. Equipped.
So a story like this is not our usual thing, but what got us interested in talking to Tom about it is that when you hear these tapes...
Who do we want to shoot? Lots of people.
You're not quite sure how to feel.
When do we want to shoot them?
Yesterday.
That's right.
Like, should I laugh? Like, oh, these are just some old dudes getting a little heated. Or,
hit and run,
should I be really afraid? And it made us wonder, like, how do you know when someone's really a threat or when they're just flapping their gums?
Right. And that is the fault line that the story tries to explore.
I'm curious to meet, as much as you've met, the four guys in question. I mean, what are they like?
I've not met any of them. They are in jail. You can't get to them.
But based on what you learned, what can you tell us?
Well, I mean, I went the most interesting of them to me was Fred Thomas.
All right, so who's willing to take a life?
He's the guy you hear talking the most on the tapes.
Who's willing to take a life?
Fred Thomas was a career Navy guy working outside of Washington, D.C., comes down here to be close to his son.
This is late 2008.
Right before...
Prepared to take the oath, Senator?
I am.
Obama.
I, Barack Hussein Obama.
Is inaugurated as president.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
And for whatever reason, you know, he begins to see his dreams going sour.
President to the United States faithfully.
And he begins, you know, going on to these militia sites, saying that the country that he served has now abrogated his trust.
Pretty soon, he's hosting militia meetings at his house, ranting about how it's time for them to do something.
Are you committed to taking action?
And in November 2011, Fred finds himself, along with some of the other guys, in a white truck in a Walmart parking lot, meeting with an arms dealer to buy a silencer for a fully automatic assault rifle and two fully built bombs made of C4 explosive.
The bomb that they were accused of buying was actually sort of an IED. It was a cell phone triggered device. And that's a little bit scary, for sure.
When you heard these tapes, were you alarmed?
Sure. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I heard the tapes before I went to Fred Thomas's house. You know, when you pull up to their house in the mountains of Georgia, they have a sign in the driveway that says, Frank Sinatra fans only.
You've had your first lesson.
All others will be learning the blues.
Learning the blues.
And, you know, when I pulled up to that house and when I saw that sign and when I went into the, you know, Sinatra shrine room there, you know, I realized that they weren't
typical militia
what
types.
I expected. Exactly.
He then learns that right at the height of his planning, right as Fred Thomas is saying things like,
I could shoot ATF and IRS all day long.
I could shoot ATF and IRS all day long.
All the judges in the DOJ.
As Fred was saying all this, he was in really poor health.
I mean, he already has, you know, a variant of emphysema that causes him to, you know, have to drag around an oxygen tank wherever he goes. He already can't get up the stairs. Hmm. The month before the first meeting takes place, he has half a lung removed.
Really?
Yeah.
When you listened to this tape, what did you think about the potential of this fellow to do something real?
I mean, he sounds sane on this thing. He sounds determined.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether he or anyone could have done it.
Because of age and health?
Right.
Well, wouldn't they have said that about James von Bruen, the guy who shot up the Holocaust Museum?
As we started thinking about this story, we ended up calling Dina Temple-Raston.
I'm NPR's counterterrorism correspondent.
And she kind of complicated the age argument for us because she said this guy, James von Bruen,
white supremacist,
on June 10th, 2009,
he walked right up to the Holocaust Museum. The guard opened the door. He shot him at point-blank range and then started shooting up the museum.
Oh, my God.
89 years old.
89?
89.
She called us back later to say, actually, he was 88, but still.
If you saw this man, frail.
Wow.
Does that fit any sort of profile? It doesn't.
So the fact that Fred Thomas was 73 and dragging around an oxygen tank doesn't mean anything.
That's right.
Yeah, in fact, I felt like when he was talking about how old and expendable.
I'm old. I'm expendable.
And how, I mean, he was going to die soon.
I ain't got a lot of time left on this earth anyway. 5, 8, 10 years at the most.
Now he wanted to, like, leave something behind for his grandchildren and fix the country before he went out.
I want this country to be good for my grandchildren. If it takes killing some people here now, I'm willing.
Like, suddenly he felt Like he was scary because he was so old and infirm.
This is a guy with nothing to lose, wanting to go out in a blaze of glory.
Exactly, yeah. And it felt it felt weirdly like the things that other real terrorists say.
Right.
There was a abandon to the way that he was talking about himself.
But if you go past that little sentence, like which I noticed too, and then you go and learn anything else, then suddenly it gets dull again. That's the way it seems to me.
Well, he's far from, you know, a lot of these guys who do these things are rootless. He is far from rootless.
Like, contrast him with the guy Dina told us about, Von Braun, who had no family, no friends.
The only connection he had to the world was his computer.
And just before his shooting spree?
He gave away his computer. So he was ready to die.
Tom says that is not Fred's story.
For all the violence of his rhetoric, he's shown for 73 years of life no inclination towards violence, no inclination towards crime. He's been, a loyal husband, a devoted father. He's lived, in some ways, a blameless life. And that is always why I thought that, you know, really, if someone had, you know, the sheriff had pulled up to his house and said, hey, listen, we know what you're doing, we know what you're up to, just, you know, get lost. If I hear about this again, I'm going to come out and you're going to be in trouble. To me, it would have been over.
So you think that if anyone had knocked on the door and said, we know what you're up to, just quit it, just cut it out.
Absolutely.
You think they would have gone away?
Absolutely.
But how can you be so sure about that?
I just think that there was an element of fantasy in this thing, which is scary, but present in almost all of it.
We ended up going back and forth on this for quite a while with Tom and Robert saying the government might be taking these guys too seriously.
But he didn't. He didn't shit any.
And then Pat and Jad saying, well, how can the government not take them seriously? Dina, can we get your take here?
Sure.
If you're faced with tapes of octogenarians talking about using ricin and spreading it on the highway to kill dozens, hundreds of people, however far-fetched it may seem, what do you do? I mean, is there a way that you can get to some sort of like clarity as to like, here's when I ignore them, and once they pass this line, and here's the line right here, I can put my finger on it, then we act. Is there a line? I mean, what do you do if you're the FBI?
You know, it's a gut thing. In the end, for law enforcement, it's a gut thing, and they have to decide whether or not somebody's a real threat or whether it's somebody they have to watch. But what they started doing is actually letting these so-called plots go a bit further. For example, there was a man named Samadi. They found him in a chat room talking about loving al-Qaeda's ideas and wanting to do something against the United States.
Sort of like our militia guys.
Right. So basically, they introduced someone to Samadi and said that he was an al-Qaeda sort of affiliate guy, could help him get the explosives he needed, would help him get a van in which he could put the explosives so he could drive it into the garage of this big skyscraper in Dallas. And so Samadi did all this.
He called the guy. They got the van. They filled it with explosives.
Yes, everything that this guy suggested. But here's the important point. So they put the van in the basement of the building, and this FBI-affiliated person hands a phone to Samadi and says, dial this number, and it'll blow up the bomb.
And where are they standing at this point? Are they anywhere near this building?
They're in a car watching they're actually in a car apart from the building so they could watch the explosion.
Wow.
Anyway, they're apart from the building, and they're watching it. And he hands Samadi the phone, and Samadi dials the number he tells him to dial. And I don't know if this is an apocryphal part of the story or not, but it was actually the phone number for the local FBI office, and he was arrested.
Oh, so he gave Samadi the phone and said, dial this number, the building will blow up right in front of our eyes. And Samadi did it.
Exactly.
That's beautiful police work.
That's
what I pay my police to do. If they can do that thing, that's brilliant.
I would want to do that to all of them. Like, I would want to give that phone to everyone who's saying that they want to blow up a building.
Yeah, because it resolves the central debate here, which is
whether the possible is
possible becomes the probable, yeah.
Because if he's willing to dial the number, then you have your answer.
But okay, here's the caveat. Because I think a lot about this, because there was a time a couple of years ago when we had something in the neighborhood of 14 of these kinds of cases in 1 year.
The caveat, she says, is that if they dial the cell phone, yeah, that seems to settle things, but they would never have dialed it had you not given it to them.
And so one way of looking at this, and I haven't fully resolved this for myself, is that if you get them stirred up, the fact that they're willing to dial the phone, you got them stirred up in the first place.
On the other hand, the fact that they were willing to dial the phone means that they were willing to dial the phone.
So let's get down to what we can do. What are we willing to do?
And you have something of the same tension in this case, the Fred Thomas case, and that's really the heart of Tom's objection. Like, the whole reason we have these secret tapes that we've been listening to is because the FBI recruited a confidential informant, a guy named Joe Sims, to infiltrate the meetings, and he wore a wire. And on the tape, you hear this guy, Joe Sims, suggest to Fred Thomas and the guys that they should buy explosives.
Again, we didn't know what the price was. If you're saying it's a grand for a stick.
Which apparently cost $1,000.
Give me a stroke already.
Sorry, guys. It is what it is.
We didn't know.
As you can hear, Fred says there's no way he can afford that. So Joe Sims chips in to help them buy it using government money. And then finally, he sets up that meeting with the arms dealer.
That eventually led to these guys' arrest. I mean, if they weren't even at some sort of level going to do it without the addition of Joe Sims and an undercover FBI agent, it comes really, really close to prosecuting thought crimes. Yeah. You know, there is an apparatus at work here that is precisely the apparatus that these guys fear.
Well, they weren't prosecuted for what they said. They were prosecuted for what they did.
This is Sally Yates,
the United States Attorney in the Northern District of Georgia. When you put together a list of people and groups that you want to kill, when you conduct surveillance on both the ATF and IRS buildings here in Atlanta, when you make arrangements to buy bombs and silencers, that's not a thought crime. I think you ought to ask yourself, is that something you want law enforcement to walk away from? Are we absolutely certain that they were going to act on this? And I'm not going to pretend that we were. But we were certain that that was not a risk that we were willing to take.
We should probably hear this, the final. So at the end of the day, what happens?
Well, at the end of the day, they meet in a parking lot in Cornelia, Georgia. Joe Sims is waiting there in a white Ford 150 truck with the undercover agent.
Who is the undercover agent pretending to be?
He's pretending to be an arms dealer. They are there to buy a silencer, and they are there to buy the explosive.
So what happens?
They get into the truck. Sims has a wad of bills that is actually supplied by the government. He gives it back to the government, so to speak. He hands it to the undercover agent. Fred Thomas hands his money to the undercover agent. The undercover agent steps out and says, I got to make a cell phone call. Makes the cell phone call. I talked to the manager of the Captain D's that was being built in the parking lot there. They were there that day. And a Chevy Suburban and a big van comes ripping by these guys as they're going out to lunch. And the manager says to the owner, well, don't look now, but there's a SWAT team in that Chevy Suburban. That thing comes in and, you know, within seconds, these guys are out. They throw flash grenades in the bed of the white pickup truck where Dan Roberts and Fred Thomas are sitting.
Flash grenades.
You know, flash grenades are those things that, you know, they explode with a blinding burst of light and also, you know, tremendous loud noise. The whole purpose of that thing is just shock and awe. They throw the flash grenades. They get these guys out. They go face down on the pavement. They're encircled by a SWAT team in full armor, automatic weapons trained at their heads. And my sources from the Captain D's said that one of the things that they noticed when they stood up was, you know, they both had, you know, stained their pants.
Because they were so scared.
Yeah. Do you feel any safer?
No.
Not sure.
Kinda.
Yes.
Thanks to Tom Janot and to our own Pat Walters.
Yeah.
And
thanks to you for listening.
Yeah.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
See ya.
I am Haru Zamsky, a Radio Lab listener from Portland, Oregon.
and Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Message 2.
Hi, this is Ellen calling from Akumal, Mexico. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Soren Wheeler is senior editor. Jamie York is our senior producer. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Brenna Farrell, David Gebel, Matt Kilty, Robert Krolowich, Annie McEwen, Andy Mills, Latif Nasser, Melissa O'Donnell, Kelsey Badgett, Ariane Wack, and Molly Webster, with help from Alexandra Lee Young, Jackson Roach, and Charu Sinha. Our fact checkers are Eva Dasher and Michelle Harris.
End of message.